welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week we're joined by Enrique Anton Rivero, who's Portuguese. And he's talking about Catalonia, because many people don't realise Portugal also fought an independence struggle with Madrid, as is also right now Galicia and the Basque Country. And this is going to set the scene. Will the European Union be able to continue? We shall see. And we'll also be hearing Canciones Libertarios, that is, Songs of Liberty from the Spanish struggles. And part two of John Bamfield. He's a trade union activist in Bath. He'll be talking about his industrial relations degree that he took 20 or so years ago, and also his work for the Citizens Advice Bureau. And he's working now with something called Bath Against the Cuts. He explains why. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. We're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. And I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show. Well, that was a song called La Barracadas from the 1930s, and it's from a collection called Canciones Libertarias, which is anarchist songs or songs of liberty from Spain. And joining me in the studio is Enrique Anton Rivero to talk about what's been going on in Catalonia. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, Tony. How are you, sir?
Fine. And this is something, I suppose, which is of interest to you. You're Portuguese, and I think there is a certain, I suppose, there are a lot of Portuguese looking at Spain and say, thank God we got separate from Madrid.
Yes, thank God, long time ago, we don't have anything to do with it.
What's the history there then?
I think the oldest history there is that we are Gaelics, we are from, and we have a right of our own culture. We are different, and the king of Spain is Moorish, is from the North Africa.
Okay, that's Felipe.
Felipe, his father, yeah, his blood still runs from Moor.
And his father was Juan Carlos.
The first.
Right, and actually it was Franco that said, I want Juan Carlos to take over once I die. This is the fascist leader of Spain until the 1970s. Yes.
But he was hidden until the revolution finished in Lisbon.
Really?
Yeah. The king was hidden in Cascais as a refugee or in exile until the revolution finished and all the situation with the war.
Okay, so we're not really just talking about Catalonia today. No. We're also looking at Galicia, the Basque Country, and Portugal in a and way Portugal. As having a bit of a problem with Madrid. So what is the problem?
I think the government or the kingdom in Madrid, they don't want to release Portugal, Galicia, Basque and Catalonia. They didn't have a chance. Luckily, Catalonia is free nowadays. But is because there will be gridlock in land. They will stay closed in land by the Mediterranean. And with Gibraltar, they don't have any goods passing through to Spain, apart from the North Africa and old times.
Well, hang on, because...
And I think it's political. I
mean, explain why that matters then. Because a lot of goods travel by aircraft, etc. nowadays,
but, no? But I understand that. But imagine that you have a country, yeah, that starts to lose counties. Imagine England now start to lose Cornwall to the Cornish, Devon to all the rest.
Now, you know, what occurs to me is that actually Cornwall's Gaelic, the island is Gaelic.
And Portugal is
Welsh
Gaelic.
Welsh is Gaelic, and west of Scotland's Gaelic. I mean, yes. So this is actually something quite similar between the British Isles and Portugal.
It is.
Iberian Peninsula.
It is. And I don't understand why Portugal and England, some of the Gaelic nations, are so quiet about nowadays. Because if we still, in our name, we say we are the port of the Gaelics, yeah? We are oldest and the strongest ally of England. But before allies of England, we were allies of Ireland and Scotland. And... with all of these, treaties that we always honourable to it, why nowadays, even with the situation of the Brexit, Catalonia coming out of Spain and being an independent province?
I mean, okay,
province,
so you're saying that as if it's happened. It hasn't really.
And
what do you think is going to happen? What's your crystal ball for?
My crystal ball is like this: Madrid won't allow it. They will pretend. They will find a trick even on the media to allow it, to make the people believe, okay, we are semi-free, like independent, like Madeira or the Azores or Falklands or something like that. But they won't allow it, a whole province like Catalonia, to get out of their side.
So
there's
what,
the border to one of the borders to France.
So are the other regions, like the Basques, the Galicians, watching closely?
They must be, because Galicia always wanted to be free and to be with Portugal. And the Basque, we know what they've done. And why the Basque? The ETA doesn't say anything?
Well, maybe they're keeping their powder dry.
Yes, I hope so. Let's hope so.
What about the Franco regime, though? Because this is something I think hasn't really been talked about very much so far. The Catalonian president has been raising this as a potential.
Yes.
We don't want to go back there. But it was actually in the 1930s a Holocaust, a really horrific situation with... I know, with Franco going from town to town, his forces going from town to town, going through each town and taking out a lot of the intellectuals, taking out anyone that didn't support him. And there are mass graves with hundreds of thousands of dead Spanish.
There is like villages with the 200 people that they were machine gunned at that time completely, because they were... lectures, they were independent, they were autosufficient. Whatever threat they found on them, there were massacres happened, and it's not long ago. If we see 1930s, it's not so long ago.
It's funny, isn't it? This is all happening just as the last people who remember that are dying.
Yes.
Maybe just a few people in their 80s and 90s,
90s, 8, 6, the 89s. Maybe that one's there, remember. And that ones are the patriarchs on the north. And they were always pee-pee, you know, the
People's Party.
The People's Party, that is the Fascist Party.
Well, that's the party in charge now with Rajoy.
Yeah, that's the Fascist Party.
It is.
It's easy. On the continent, in here, I don't know if it works like that. But if it was like here, like the continent, the conservative would be fascist and the labor will be communist, because it's the colors. Blue goes for fascist, red goes for communism.
But what about the whole... It's something always struck me as peculiar about the Spanish Civil War, and it's happened in many other kind of... In fact, the same sort of thing with white Russians as well, is you get a kind of fascist Marxist elite that say they're the Christian party. Yes. And yet the Marxist party, whoever they happen to be, are very anti-Christian,
yes.
Which seems kind of wrong, really, because a lot of what they're fighting for, the Marxists, is social equality, which is actually more
Jesus
naturally
words. Yeah.
Christian.
Jesus words.
So
yeah.
It's a sort of twisted thing at the heart of these.
It is. It is. Because the situation that I've been found out and I studied and that my granddads, they spoke, and great-granddads, they always spoke about it, is the... Whatever is the black, maybe it's not, but whatever is the idea, the ideology that you take, the objective is still to control and entertain the masses. Because it's like we said a few years ago, a few are wise enough or think they have the power and the wisdom to control the others. So with the distraction of the society, they can relish the words in being kind and being for the people, as others can say, if we give to the boss, the employer gonna have. But the is like, my granddad used to say, I don't know if this is swearing or not, but he's like, what changes is the flies, but the manure, Winnie the Pooh is the same, exactly the same. It stays the same.
Yeah, but that is, I just find it fascinating that these various revolutions that we've seen, China, Russia, all these sorts of things have got that at the heart of it, is that, so do you think that there's a hope for Catalonia now? Where are we going to be maybe in a few months' time? I mean, it really does seem like there is going to be no agreement between Madrid and Barcelona.
My opinion is that I see it really hard. It's with sadness that I let them know in Catalonia that I don't see Madrid to release them like that. If Philippe would say, if they would give the independence to Catalonia, what they're going to be doing with the Basque and with Galicia that have been asking for independence before Catalonia. So these ones have been shouting since the primordial times of existence of Spain. What they're going to do with it?
The European Union in Brussels has also been quite interesting in the what little they've said about the abuses of human rights over there. I mean, the police brutality towards people voting. We had the BBC reporting it as protesters clashing with police. Well, actually, yes, these aren't protesters, they're voters queuing up to vote. That's not a protest.
It's not.
So the BBC keep getting that wrong.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, that kind of clash is not being recognised by the European Union in Brussels as a problem. They're, so basically, they're backing Felipe, they're backing Rajoy, they're backing the People's Party.
And as they're backing Felipe, they're backing the government in Venezuela. Because this is just a consequence of what is happening in Venezuela. Also.
What's Venezuela got to do with it?
Look, please, Venezuela is one of the biggest countries, yeah, with infrastructure and natural resources in South America that is Spanish.
Not Portuguese, unlike Brazil, for example.
Yeah, unlike Brazil, that is Portuguese. All of this family, all of these people that have been running away from the war in Venezuela, from the civil war in Venezuela, that this conflict had been there for 3-4 years and no one... The media have been silent, just now started to speak about it.
Well, they had a vote, didn't they, just recently, and actually the socialists have got a resounding victory.
Yeah.
But we haven't heard that very much.
Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing. And now... the Spanish are fighting for independence. There is not, the people are not happy in Spain. The cleanliness of Spain is not the same. The industry keep working. Okay, they still have the foundations open. England is opening some foundations, some foundries. So I don't know what's happened. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense on this trilogy. Fight there, loads of resources, natural resources in Venezuela,
oil,
diamonds, gold, everything, cows, milk, the Spanish need all of that. Need all of that. The communism party with Fidel released in Cuba. The everyone is going to Cuba to take a little bit of the old stuff and to play. And what are we going to do? We have Venezuela being robbed. Spain in need of money. New king, new law, but the ideology is still the same. Frankist.
The fact is that we've got this thing, the Gürtel scandal in Spain, which was to do with corruption in the People's Party, where they were getting kickbacks from brown envelopes, very big ones, with millions of euros in, from big construction companies.
Prime ministers in Portugal arrested. Old prime ministers from the government in Portugal arrested. And loads of people of the government. And why you need a country with four intelligence services? Why a country so small like Portugal have four intelligence services? So one works for the Russians, one works for the Queen, the loyal one, one works for who? To the people? And the other. It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. And how are they going to do? What is this opinion? Why they keep quiet about the Brexit? Why Portugal is not in favor of the Brexit? Why is not in favor of the alliance with England? And both put the cards in the table and decide.
Well, I mean, you do look at this situation sometimes and think, well, most of these leaders are actually working against the interests of their own people.
Yeah, but they are working on the interests of all of them in common. The wealth of them in common has been decided and been transported, I've been told, by Intel, to Brazil. So the Russians have been transported to Brazil. The Jews have been transported to Brazil. The Germany have been investing in Brazil like there is no eyes, there is no tomorrow. So what's happening? The next big...
This is BRICS, isn't it? The Brazilians are a big player in the BRICS countries.
Waiting
for the dollar to collapse and the pound to collapse and the euro to
collapse. And the Brazilian coin will come up.
Also interesting, the Russian currency is pretty good. A lot of people good place to invest in Moscow.
Yes, always was, always will be. Because nowadays, I don't understand. If we have so much elite, so much wealth in London, let's say London, imagine London is just one country by itself.
Well, it is, isn't it? The city of London is.
It's a country.
The Queen has to ask permission if she wants to enter the city of London.
The city of London. So all of that city of London is banked. Bank is money. And and everything won from China, from Russia, from Qatar, from Kuwait, from Morocco, from Portugal, have been taking money to here. How much? Let's think about in private safe. In private safes, we have around 300 billion on bullion in gold. In private safes, and this is the declared ones. So, how much more money exists just on the city of London?
And yet, we can't afford to pay people enough to eat. Apparently,
apparently, we can't afford even homes for them.
It does seem like a kind of gangster state we're living in.
It is. Anyway. All the world in it at the same time.
I think some places are worse than others. But anyway, look, let's just talk, because before we came in, we were chatting briefly about the British crown, the monarchy, and the power of that, because there are questions, aren't there, about the succession to the throne here. Because Prince Charles is very keen to take over the Queen's duties, but there's also a lot of pressure to say, well, we should skip a generation.
My auntie always said that. Charles doesn't have a chance. No one that supports Charles can be sure. I can tell you, be sure that what it says on the family and what always was said by my auntie, Her Majesty, the Queen of this country, of this realm, is Charles never going to be king.
Why not?
Because it's not for him. He's a different kind of person. He's not on his he's on his blood, but he's not on his spirit.
But he has he does have these delusions of grandeur, doesn't he? He likes to be the big
guy. But it's good. He have a factory that plays cookies. He have the Prince trusses. He have loads of things. He even can play with helicopters if he feels like it. But he is not the point. We need new blood. That's what the Philippe appeared now. We need new blood. And the monarchy will come up with new blood. How old is this guy from North Korea? 30s? How old is Philippe? 30s? How old is William? 30s? How old is the one of Austria? 30s?
So, yes, maybe you're right. They are preparing a kind of new generation of elite. Yeah. So it's the idea is putting all these people in place.
But they're never going to disrespect their father or their granddad.
I mean, I've been looking into the Order of the Garter because this is quite an ancient order which surrounds the British monarchy. It's 26 people, including the various, like the Prince Charles, the successor to the throne, the heir to the throne, the heir to the throne's heir. So they try and keep them all in this small group of these two sets of 13. So some have even suggested this is witchcraft and that you've got actually two covens of witches, which are the Order of the Garter. Interesting the timing of when it started, when a secret sign, the garter itself is a secret sign that Countess Salisbury was wearing. Apparently she was a witch, under her skirt. So she could lift up her skirt and you could see she's a witch. Yeah, but she was had a great influence over Edward III and got the Order of the Garter started just a few years. Well, the Templars were dissolved in 1312 by Philip the Fair. Within about 30, 40 years, the Order of the Garter started. So the Templars, the Knights Templar, it looks as if there was a sort of resurgence.
Yes, it's like KGB, they just swap name.
And I always just find it interesting that people just don't realise that you've got this kind of bunch of people that are managing the monarchy. The idea is she's supposed to be in charge, the Queen.
Yes.
But there's a whole management team around
the round table. It's like a story. You understand? It's like this. They still have these people sit down around themselves. Yeah, the 26, the 13 by 13 places on the table. The table still round. They still believe in King Arthur and in the Excalibur. They lock it on the Tower of London. Whatever story they can believe to themselves, but they need to control.
It's a myth.
It is a myth. But the control is not a myth.
Now, I mean, it sounds almost like a form of fundamentalism. It's like we believe this thing so much that it's become a reality from a myth.
Yes. What they've done with the Olympics. What it was the show off on the Olympics? For the first time, after so many millenniums of this realm, it was told to everyone that exists a wonderland. You understand?
Anyway, let's get back to Catalonia. We're going to hear in a minute another song from the Canciones Libertarias. Is that the right pronunciation?
Si.
The anarchist liberty songs. And it's called Viva la Fai. Have I pronounced that right?
Viva la Fai.
Viva la Fai. Can you just say something about what your hopes are for Barcelona?
I hope no one gets hurted. I hope they don't get persecuted forever. I hope that the kids don't destroy much of the historical things of the town. And I hope that they succeed on their fight, that they get better things that they have now, more freedom, they have more transparency, more auditories and transparency on the accounts of the government.
But if there's young people listening who are
fighting for it,
are involved in this, what advice would you, as an old hand at this from Portugal, what advice would you have for the youngsters?
I think that the fight is a good fight. They should keep fighting. They don't let them ever tell you that is not good. Fight for your rights. Fight for your rights. Be honest, but be cautious. Be cautious because the lion is urging. He's roaring. They are roaring. They are upset because all of these revolutions is happening everywhere. We didn't have been so contactable because the social media is really, 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 really controlled. And
Hang on, because social media is one of the only ways people are talking to each other nowadays. The youngsters, where they look at, they're looking at, they're saying, well, actually, the Catalonian radio and TV is being taken over by Madrid.
Yes, yes. Is that the situation? We need to have, we need to maybe go for the backtrack meetings like we used to do before.
I remember in Egypt during the Arab Spring, which of course ended up being a total disaster, and maybe a psyop by the RAND Corporation.
Yes.
But over there, when they switched off Facebook, everybody came out on the streets and started having meetings in the streets.
Meetings on the streets. Meeting on the streets, meeting on the club, do parties, disguise them as parties. Don't let them take the right to freedom.
Enrique Anton Rivero, thanks very much for joining us. And we'll finish with Viva La Fai.
Viva La Fai. So thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Viva la paz y la CNT, luchemos hermanos contra los tiranos y los requetes. Rojo pendón, negro color, luchemos hermanos aunque en la batalla debamos morir.
Los tiempos de Rivera y Jorge Mata, los machistas no querían matar.
Rojo pendón, negro color, luchemos hermanos ante la batalla de vamos a morir. Si los curas y frailes supieran la paliza que van a llevar, irían al coro gritando libertad, libertad, libertad.
That was Viva La Fai, a traditional revolutionary song from Spain. And let's not forget, we had the fascists up until 1975 running Spain, which is why they have a pretty strong and living memory tradition of fighting fascism in Spain. Now we're going to hear the second part of our interview with John Bamfield. He's from Bath, runs at the moment something called Bath Against the Cuts. He's the chair. And also we're going to start, though, by hearing about his industrial relations degree that he did after being a convener at Bath Press, that enormous building you see on the way in on the A4 into Bath on the right-hand side. So back to Bath, back to you, and your, I suppose, in a way, it was like a busman's holiday doing an industrial relations degree.
It was harder than I thought. I thought that, like, I could go and, because I'd be driving a forklift in the cold for 8 hours, you get really tired. And I thought sitting about in the university would be easy, but it wasn't. I was tired working at the university. The other thing that surprised me at university was I thought there would be arguments and debate between the students and the lecturers. But when I was at university, what surprised me was only the mature students would ever raise problems and argue points. The younger students were, I don't know why, but they very rarely spoke.
Were they a bit
class.
Docile, do you think? They're not really got inquiring minds, or what was going on there?
I don't know. Part of my course, because it was an industrial relations course, I had to do it in the School of Management. Some of the course was on negotiations, or so industrial law, and I used to share the classroom with students who were doing the business management course, and they were mostly sons and daughters of people who were managers and stuff like that. I used to call them Thatcher's children.
So in a way, they're being taught how to beat the unions in a negotiation, aren't they?
Partly, yeah. But they weren't, they surprisingly weren't very good at it. Like when we're doing industrial law negotiations, we'd get a case study. And the lecturer, we had a barrister doing industrial law teaching us, and she would give us a case study, and then she would give us rows. So we would talk about a dispute in a factory, and she would say, you're the convener, you're the manager, you're the personnel manager, so on and so on. And I managed to, I didn't mind what I did, and I was, because I'd been a part of the negotiation team, I used to read the case study religiously over the weekend and check all the facts. So I knew what I was doing, but we had this one guy who was one of these Thatcher's children, and he was a managing director, and he came in on Monday morning and he said, well, I'm going to sack all the workforce. And Barca said, well, didn't you see on page two, they had a big order coming up and it was really skilled work and it'd take them a year to retrain anybody. So it's that, those sort of things. I did enjoy university, I sort of, I must say.
I suppose, did you sort of skip A-levels then and O-levels when you left at 15? You know,
I had no qualifications whatsoever.
Right, great. So you went straight to do the degree.
I did an access course. I had to do an access course.
Amazing.
But I thought the access course was good because when you went for an access course, what you got to think about is you're dropping out of mainstream work with a family, doing a year at college and then going to university. But what they did in Bath is they interviewed you for the university place at the same time as they interviewed you for the access course. So it would be somebody from the college and somebody from the university. And you would get a place if you passed the access course, basically. You were told you had a place. So you worked hard at the access course. You had an automatic place in the University of Bath.
How did you feel then doing a proper degree after having not had these sort of qualifications people normally need to go to get there, having done the access course?
The worst thing about it was my maths and English was and my spelling is atrocious.
Yeah.
But I realised quite early on how to work it. And because I'd been part of negotiations, I was quite good at looking at both sides of an argument. And that was really vital because when you write essays, I don't know if you've been to university, you have to put both sides of the argument. And I was good at that because when you go into negotiations in a factory, you try to work out what the management are going to sort of argue. And it's quite strange because when I left Bath Press, for the whole time at university, let me go back and drive my forklift in the summer, as long as I didn't do any union work. And in a weird way, they were proud of the fact that one of the workers had gone to use. They said, we did it because we gave you such a rough time in negotiations. You learned so much. You got into university doing an industrial relations course. After that, what did I do after that?
Because so suddenly, you're not at Bath Press anymore, are you? You've got your industrial relations degree, but you're not actually a convener anymore.
No, I think when I started the degree, my idea was to go and get a job with a union. But by this time, the union's membership was falling; they needed less full timers and that lot. So, I went to work at Big Issue as a legal worker, and I became skilled in benefit law and housing law. And which I taught myself on the job, basically. And I
so
did
was
that.
This for the actual Big Issue vendors?
Yeah, yeah, oh, okay. Yeah. They, I had nothing to do with the magazine. I was their legal worker, and I used to cover the whole of the Southwest, all the way down to Plymouth and up to Gloucester and everything in between. And I used to turn up and help them out with housing benefits and when they come into conflict with the criminal justice system, which they did quite a bit. And then I left there because basically I got fed up with people 20 or 30 years younger than me who I was working with dying, basically, because street homeless people die at quite young ages. And so I then went to the Citizens Advice Bureau as a legal worker, not as a volunteer. I was paid by them, or I was paid by the Legal Aid Board, actually. And mainly I did tribunals, representing people at tribunals over here in Bristol.
Okay, so if someone is either been sacked or threatened with something at work?
It's mainly benefits I did.
Okay.
Yeah. I've done a couple of industrial tribunals, but it's mainly benefit tribunals. And most of it would be about sort of people have attended medicals and found fit for work, and we would go and argue that they weren't fit for work, basically.
Okay, what about some of the activism that you've been doing since the Citizens Advice Bureau? I mean, Bath Against the Cuts. We hear in Bristol from time to time about BADACO, I think they're called, Bristol and District Anti-Cuts Alliance, but we don't hear much about Bath over in Bristol. So what's going on over there?
Well, we formed Bath Against the Cuts in 2010, and we get people from all different persuasions, everything from,
conservatives?
No conservatives. We get a couple of Lib Dems, Green Party, Labour Party people, anarchists. Anarchists were people who helped us set it up, and we get on quite well. Like, you don't have the infighting in Bath that you do in Bristol. The real infighting in Bath politically is between different sections of the Labour Party. So we've been working on that. We worked on several things.
I mean, hang on a minute, though, because you can be against the cuts, but surely you must understand that the government, after the bailout of the banks in 2008, just simply doesn't have the money to spend anymore.
I don't believe that. They caused the banking crisis. Capitalist bankers called the banking crisis. And they're asking the most vulnerable people in society to pay for it. And saying we're broke is ridiculous. In 1945, when my dad came back from the war, Britain was broke. The Americans had withdrawn any aid. There was massive austerity then. But that government still demobilised 6 million people from the armed forces, built masses of council houses, created the National Health Service, and created a welfare state. Now Britain is fifth richest country in the world, and we can't afford anything. And bankers are still getting massive bonuses, people who caused the problem in the first place, but people who are ill or vulnerable are being asked to pay for the crisis. Sorry about that rant.
That's all right. So give us an idea of the sorts of people who are involved in Bath Against the Cuts, and, you know, what the objectives and aims are.
It's mainly to fight any cuts, because we realise that what authorities do is they play one section of people off against the other. So if you say we prefer these cuts rather than that cuts, you're playing into their hands. So we have a policy. We've learnt to what we've done. We've stopped them closing the library. We stopped them withdrawing money from the Citizens Advice Bureau. We kept some sort of kids' centres open. We've done stuff on the bedroom tax. What we're quite good at is there's a rule in Bath, the council rule. If you can get 1,000 signatures, I think, you get a chance to address the council. Now, you must discuss it in a council meeting. So we're quite good at that. And what we do is we get people to speak in a council meeting, but at the same time have a demonstration outside. And so that's how we work, basically. And we're quite good at mobilising people.
So does Bath have its own city council and a North East Somerset council separate?
No, it's Bath and North East Somerset council. And the Bath bit is made up of Lib Dems and Tories. There's one Labour councillor from inside Bath, from one of the old council estates. But he was the first Labour councillor from inside the seat for 15 years.
Well, why has Labour failed so dismally in Bath then, do you think? Although it seems to be coming back maybe recently, but...
It's come back a bit. I think the biggest mistake they made is in the 60s and 70s, they took council estates for granted and tried to put all their effort into more middle-class areas. And the Lib Dems were very good. They, at the time, they had a sort of focus on social housing estates, and they were quite good. It was, you didn't see Labour until an election, but the Lib Dems did a lot of work in between.
Also, you're on the Trades Council, aren't you? What's your role there?
I'm a chair.
Chair of the Trades Council. Okay, so tell us a bit about Bath Trades Council, because that's the idea of getting all the different unions in the city all together in one place, maybe once a month.
Yeah? That's right, yeah. We're quite small now. When I first went on the Trades Council in 1972, we had 60-odd delegates, and the local paper would send a reporter along to the meetings. Now we're down to about 10 delegates. But we do some stuff. We had a couple of years ago, we had a very good education day on the miners' strike because it was the anniversary, which drew 200 people. Recently, we had a day school on fascism and racism. And we showed films and had talks. I did a talk on Cable Street.
What's Cable Street?
Cable Street is when Oswald Mosley and the British Union fascists tried to march through the East End of London in 1936 and got beaten by the people who stopped them marching. It was quite well attended, and what we did specially was we found the Syrian refugees who lived in Bath, and the women, they did Syrian food and we paid them, sort of thing. And then they brought their kids in, so we had a party for the kids at the end.
So who's on the Trades Council now then? Which unions appear?
Mainly from the university, UCU, NUT. We got quite a few, like, I don't represent a union branch on the Trades Council. I'm a life member. The TUC in London made me a life member because of my services to unions and Bath. So we had a couple of people who are life members. Somebody from the FBU. We have tried quite hard to get other unions involved, but without much success.
I suppose it's just a symptom, really, of the scaling down of industry in the city.
Yeah, we get far more people to anti-cuts meetings than we do to the Trades Council, unfortunately.
What's on the horizon with the cuts in Bath, then?
The council are saying they need to make more cuts, but they haven't said where they are yet. They're really annoyed that we stopped the move in the library. What Bath Council have got a habit of doing is making a decision without consulting anybody. Then there's an outroar of people, and then they consult. And when they were going to move the library, they were just going to move it. There was an outcry, and then they had to consult, and people had a vote, and 90% of the people voted to keep it where it is, and they're very annoyed about that. Sometimes they get away with stuff. Last year, there was a big campaign around Virgin Health getting lots of the services in Bath, and we had marches, and we got hundreds of signatures, but they just ignored us. They just gave the contract to Virgin Health in the end, and that's run into trouble now.
Oh, really? What's happened?
A computer system isn't working.
So what are Virgin doing? I mean, my own personal experience with Virgin is they are appalling, disastrous people. They certainly shouldn't be anywhere near health, because obviously this is potentially a question of life and death. My experience with them was with on the phone, where they just simply were impossible to get hold of. Number one, you pick up the phone, you could be on there for half an hour trying to get through to speak to somebody you couldn't, even though, you know, they're supposed to be delivering a phone service. And then when I decided, look, I've had enough of this, then they kept sending me these bills for hundreds of pounds. So they were impossible to speak to. All they seemed to be interested in doing was fleecing me, you know, personally, and actually delivering nothing for it. So if they're involved in what? In what way are they involved in health?
They do mainly. They do most of the services now, which aren't being done by the hospital, and are taking bits of the hospital service over as they go.
So what's that then?
Adult care, mental health, children's care, everything. I'm not the best person to talk to me about talk about this, because we got a woman, I won't give her name because I'm out of permission, but who's on our anti-cuts campaign, who knows it backward.
Maybe we'll get her on one of the future weeks.
Yeah, she's run a campaign called Defend the NHS, and she was the mainstay of the person who fought Virgin Health.
But personally, I mean, if I had to deal with Virgin Health over my own personal health, I would be trying to go anywhere except to them.
Mm. They are pretty bad, and they've been pretty bad. What is it? The thing is, they only come in to bid for contracts because they think they can make a profit. And some things in society, they shouldn't be made for profit because they cut corners.
Now, also going on at the moment is the controversy over Fox Hill. This isn't directly, maybe, I don't know if you're involved in it or not, but it's not the council, it's Curo Homes that want to knock down a load of actually rather nice council housing or housing association places up at Fox Hill. Can you just take us through what's going on up at Fox Hill?
Well, Fox Hill is an estate, quite a nice estate. It used to be council housing until Curo took it over, or Somer, but the same company. Somer took it over, but they moved into Curo. And when they were Somer, they were only interested in social housing, and they control all the old council housing in Bath. But they're now trying to break into the private market. Next to the Fox Hill estate is an old MOD place, Minister of Defence, and Curio's got control of that, and they're building private housing on there. But they want to knock the council estate on. They're going to replace some of the housing, but not all of it.
Let's just get this clear. Is Curio a housing association or not?
It's a housing association, but they've set up a separate company to run their private housing.
Ah.
There's been an outcry from the tenants. We've been helping them.
So how are the tenants going to be affected then?
Well, it depends on the rules, as far as I understand it. If you're an old council tenant who got moved over to Somer, you have more rights than people who've actually become Curio tenants since. So they have certain rights. People who've been Curio tenants up till 2011 have certain rights, but not as much as me, because I'm an old council tenant who lives in a Curio place. And then, as far as I know, since 2011, people who've taken Curio home since 2011 have no rights at all.
So does that mean that they just simply are going to be told, you've got to go by a certain date, we're knocking your house down?
Well, at the moment, it's a long-term thing. At the moment, it's all on hold because of our lobbying, and because, surprisingly, we got a lot of help from the local, in a new Lib Dem MP who beat the old Tory MP at the last election.
Who's that?
Vera Hobhouse. She's been quite helpful. What we've done is we've got ourselves a film called Dispossession. I don't know if you heard about it. It's a film made about what's happening in London and Glasgow with the attack on social housing, and the director's been down. They're making a film about Fox Hill at the moment. We've shown the film twice in Bath and got 250 people to each showing. We showed it on Fox Hill and got in the church, and we had to turn people away. Because of our lobbying, the decision has now gone to Savit Javid, Secretary of State for the Environment. And the council have given them permission. They've got through the first planning stage. So Curio have given them the go-ahead.
I mean, how many people are affected?
600 houses, I think it is.
Crikey. And, I mean, you would expect, if you're a tenant in that sort of situation, that you would immediately be offered an equivalent flat in the same area.
Well, there's been a lot of, Quiroz consult in Mornay because they're in trouble, and they have to. And there's a chance that Savage Javid will say, no, you can't do what you're doing. Before the Glenfell fire, it would have gone through on the nod, but the government are very careful now.
Because this is a regeneration. This is a regeneration scheme, they call it.
That's what
but actually, you know, in Ladbroke Grove, they talk about these things as demolition schemes.
Yeah. Yeah, the like I've been doing quite a lot of research since this come up, and this Saturday we've got a woman speaking at Bath University, a woman called Anna Minton, who's written a really good book called Big Capital about what's happening in London.
Yeah, she's author of Ground Control as well.
Ground Control as well, yeah, I've read that as well. And
which is about the privatisation of our city centres.
Yeah.
Like we've got in Bristol, you know, Cabot Circus, Broadmead, you know, you don't get any ordinary police. This is private police walking down this street. And if they don't like the look of you, they can just get rid of you.
And one of the things I'm doing, I'm organising a housing conference in Bath in the spring to look at the whole thing of social housing. One of the things I discovered when I started looking into the whole thing about social cleansing, we call it, is that you have villains and heroes on all sides. Like some of the Labour councils in London are some of the biggest...
villains.
Villains, yeah.
I'll
Haringey,
say that word
for you. Haringey is actually been really bad. They're clearing council estates just like that. So the film is really good, and we're planning to show it in Bristol quite soon.
Well, it sounds to me as if there's some real bonuses you've got in Bath, I suppose, from cutting out a lot of this left-wing infighting by trying to include everybody. What message would you have for people who are concerned about that? Because I look at the right and the conservatives, even the neo-Nazis, they don't really seem to squabble with each other very much, but the left always seem to be. It's a bit like the People's Front of Judea and the Judea People's Front in Life of Brian. They're forever sticking knives in each other's backs, and sometimes that just means that they leave the Tories to just get on and do whatever they want.
I think how we work on Bath, or what I was encourage people to do, is if you're in campaigns, you work with people and focus on what you agree on, not what you disagree on. And we also have this thing in Bath of we do quite a lot of direct action, but because we got a broad-based thing, some people are frightened of getting arrested or taking on the law or stuff like that. So we're fine with that. People do what they want to do, and we don't sort of cast aspersions on people who won't get arrested or stuff like that. Or what's it?
Give us an idea, an example of some direct action. What do you mean?
A few years ago, during the coalition, Clegg came to Bath to do a meeting, and he turns up, and they had booked the Guild Hall. And we didn't block the entrance, but we were very close to the entrance with all our banners in that lot. And this police sergeant came up and said we had to move around the corner so Clegg didn't see us. And we refused to move, basically. So he said, so I asked him where he had got his, what authority he was using. He said, I've been told on high, from on high, that you have to move. So I said, so God told you we got to move up. So he goes away and he comes back with a woman who was power dressed in a suit, about 35. And she started going on. We had to move. And I thought she was one of Clegg's aides. So I asked her if she was. And she flashed a pass at me, which I couldn't get. And as she'd done that, I know she had a pistol underneath her jacket. So I guess she wasn't one of Clegg's aides. In the end, she was a superintendent from the Parliamentary Protection Squad. But we just refused to move. Some people were a bit nervous, but to tell you the truth, the rest of the police there weren't bothered. They didn't want any trouble. They were quite okay. In fact, when I wanted to write down this woman's details, I always carry a pen, but I don't have a pen with me. So I said, anybody got a pen? And this young copper who I'd been sort of talking to, give me his notebook to write down the details. So we unfortunately had an arrest that night, but and the guy got a conditional discharge after 2 years of it going through the courts. So we do that. We've blocked shops. Well, we did a thing on CRR contracts in Bath. But what was surprising, as soon as we turn up somewhere, do you know Bath at all? There's a posh shopping centre just by the stations. Well, when they first built that, the authorities wrote to us saying we'd never be allowed to demonstrate in there. But we've managed to get in there a few times now, mainly by sort of saying we're going to have a demonstration there and not turning up. So after 2 or 3 weeks of that, the police don't turn up and we do. But it's not to give them a due, the police in Bath isn't that bad. Aren't that bad. We've haven't had that many problems with them. We've had more problems with security guards.
Private security, yeah. I mean, that's what's happening more and more in our city centres, isn't it? You're getting private security people. But anyway, I just wanted to mention the sad death recently of Celia Hollingsworth. She died out in Greece, yeah. Apparently attacked by dogs. She's the Socialist Workers' Party, and she was, I understand, quite active in Bath.
She was on. She was in our anti-cuts campaign and in Protect Our NHS. She was a really good communicator with people. She was good on the streets selling papers or on stalls. Like, I don't particularly like doing that. I'd rather do hostile meetings and talk to members of the public. It's just something in me. But she was really good at talking to people on the street. And we used to go out together at one time, about 10 years ago.
And she was working here in Bristol, I think, wasn't she?
She was retired. She retired last year, I think.
Yeah, so real sad to see her go. But anyway, John, I suppose for the youngsters nowadays, a lot of people are looking at the world thinking, well, we're finishing our university with £50,000 worth of debt. What message have you got for young people today?
Well, a lot of people say young people aren't interested in politics. But I disagree with that, you know, sort of. They don't join political parties, except they joined the Labour Party in big numbers when Corbyn got elected. But they've always been really into single-issue campaigns. And when I've been involved in single-issue campaigns, one of the things I didn't mention is when I was younger, before I was become ill, I was ill in the 2000s, I used to act as a legal observer on demonstrations, both here and abroad. And there are lots of people on those demonstrations. And you get young people on demonstrations. Now, it's sort of when we had the library demonstrations about the mover, there's loads of young people all down to 6 years old and stuff like that. I would just say that to young people, you know, sort of... I don't feel sorry for them, but it's harder for young people now than when I left school, I think. They get misused a lot, both by the state and their employers, much more than pensioners. Like, I know pensioners, there's pensioner poverty, but the state had protected pensioners to a certain extent, mainly because we pensioners vote in large numbers, mainly for the right. And so... I would say, you know, if you believe something is wrong, join with others and fight. And I'm not particularly bothered if they join political parties or just fight on campaigns around the environment or social justice or animal rights, or as long as they do something.
Now, I notice also you're wearing this T-shirt, the European Social Forum. I mean, this is a biggie at the moment, isn't it? Brexit as well. What do you make of all that?
This was 10 years ago, I went to the European Social Forum in Florence. On Brexit, I voted to remain, but I can understand those people who argued from the left that the European community is a capitalist club. But I think why I voted Remain is because I've seen those people who were mainly advocating us leaving. And I think it was, it's given us sort of the rise of racism and sort of hate crime and that massively. It's given every little fascist thing to be a big fascist sort of thing. And I do actually believe that this country benefits enormously by migrants from abroad and stuff like that.
But we have seen a massive cut in wages. We've seen a big cut in the number of jobs since we joined the EU.
I don't think that's because of migrants. I think it's because the capitalists have taken opportunities to do that. Like what the European Community done to Greece was absolutely appalling. And
so if people want to follow your work and follow the Bath Against the Cuts, John, what should they do?
Come along to our meetings at 11 Bath, which is the first Tuesday every month at a pub called The Ram in Whitcombe.
Okay, and are you online?
Bath Against Cuts is online, yes. Just put Bath Against Cuts in and you'll get some stuff back.
John Bamfield, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
Okay.
And that was John Bamfield. The second part of the interview with him, and you can hear the first part in the previous week of Dialect at dialectradio.co.uk. That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And this week, a bit of a special because we're having for the first time, and we'll be doing this in succeeding weeks, the actual Shoestring theme from the end of the Shoestring programme. You might have noticed our theme tune is from the Shoestring programme, which was recorded in Bristol back in the 1970s. And it's just out on DVD for the first time with Network Releasing. So you can find that whole series if you want now. And we're going to finish this week and in succeeding weeks with the outro theme from Shoestring. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. And you can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk if you like. Thanks to our guests this week, Enrique Anton Rivero and John Bamfield. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. You can get hold of us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. If you've got the spare time, that is. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.